Extension number 209782, Wheel 2.
Norman Goslow, Reel 2.
I gave him the direction in which the target was travelling, and he chased it, but unfortunately the cloud astern of the convoy beat him and this thing disappeared into the cloud. So he orbited the convoy seeking further advice from me as to had I seen it. I didn't. I hadn't and I didn't see it. But we did see another target, not identified by me, another ship. We got the signal, and in fact it turned out to be a Liberator. So he investigated, but there was nothing doing. Then of course his petrol ran out eventually, or nearly ran out, and the principle was then to climb to 2,000 feet and bail out over the senior officer of the escort, who then picked him up. And this is what he did. In the middle of the Atlantic.
Which cam ship were you in?
The Empire. Empire Franklin.
How do you spell Franklin? With an I? Or a Y?
Yes, I.
So that was one attempted interception. Were there others?
The next ones were when we started the Russian convoys, and they were used there to much better advantage, because the Focke-Wulfs in the Atlantic, they recognised that they couldn't possibly cope with a Hurricane fighter. And they never tried to bomb a North Atlantic convoy plying between Halifax and UK ever again. So Churchill himself described this as a positive-negative unit. Positive in that no ships had been lost through aerial attack from Focke-Wulf Condors, and negative in that we hadn't shot any of them down. But then, when the Russian convoys became a very serious program in naval warfare, they were used, and we shot two off. I don't know. I can't remember the details. One pilot was saved, and the other, when he bailed out, the aeroplane hit him and it killed him. As he was bailing out. And he'd shot something down, you see. What the details were, I just don't know. And then I went on PQ-18, which was quite a... I've got all the details in there about it, and that was quite an interesting trip.
Can you take me through it, step by step, as you remember it, please?
Yes, I think so. We sailed from Loch U and joined up with the American contingent, and we were 40 ships strong, merchant ships, and a massive escort, close escort, and apparently, although we never saw them, a massive fleet escort in case of capital ship engagement elsewhere. We knew not where. We had our course to take to Archangel. And we were spotted as soon as we reached Iceland, and shadowed all the way until the Junkers 88s and the Heinkel 111s were in range. And then they sorted us out, or tried to. And the first attack we had was 42 Heinkels and Junkers 88s attacked in a beam attack, all in a line across the horizon, and each carrying two torpedoes. So we had 84 torpedoes attack in one go, so to speak. And we lost 8 ships in 3 minutes with a torpedo attack. We drove one or two of them off, apparently, but we weren't used on board this CAM ship because we had an aircraft carrier with us by this time, HMS Searcher. And that was, you know, our protection. And attacks continued like this, but we were almost guests, or viewers, if you like. And then the escort was narrowed down. HMS Scylla, where Admiral Burnett was conducting affairs, and the aircraft carrier left us and joined the homeward bound convoy, which was expected to run through just what we'd run through, you see. And then we were the only aerial protection all the way to Archangel. And we were attacked, but we had no, once or twice we were attacked, but it wasn't ripe for us to launch the Hurricane, because we didn't feel that with what we'd experienced, there was sufficient target to get at. But finally we were attacked by 15 Heinkels from astern, and we launched Jackie Burr on this, in this Hurricane, and he was fired. We were at stern of the convoy, and he fired off forward, of course, because you had to have the ship's speed into the wind to assist with his takeoff from the catapult. And as he took off, all ships, having seen the flashes, thought a ship had been hit, you see. So they all fired at us. And he said, "Will you stop these bastards firing at me?" And I thought, well, I didn't know how to do that, because we were getting hammered on our ship, of course. Anyway, he got round, and again, he couldn't fail to see the target, and it came in. And unfortunately, it launched its torpedoes, the whole fleet, flight, should I say, and before he got to them. And he shot at least one down, probably two, we think. And then the torpedoes came towards us, but again, fortunately for us, they were more or less spent, but they got to us, and we were able to avoid them.
Were you still in the same ship?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, not in the Franklin. No, it was just in the Empire Morn. And then he orbited the convoy for a while, and we got no further radar reports of any aircraft in our vicinity. So I said, "Well, what are you going to do, Jack?" He said, I think I'll make for Archangel, Kogostrov, which was about 240 miles away. And of course, he only had a magnetic compass. And we were virtually over the magnetic North Pole, or very close to it. And variation in those circumstances is a very, very difficult thing to calculate. So I went down to the chart room and gave him a vector of, I forget what it was now, 180, I think. And then I came back up and gave him that, because he was getting out of range, you see. He was on his way by this time. He was getting out of RT range. And I thought, I'll just check it before he goes out. And I thought, well, I think a better course would be 170. And I gave him 170. And he came out of cloud right over the airport. So I was a bit lucky there. Anyway, saved the aeroplane and saved his life, perhaps, because it was freezing cold by this time, you see. And that was PQ. When we got there, of course, we berthed alongside Bakaritsa, which was the where the convoys unloaded, put everything on the jet, on the quay side, and there it stayed for weeks. And apparently the reason was that the Germans had made such a mess of the communications, rail communications, between Archangel and Stalingrad, or wherever they were going, I think that was the ultimate destination, that they couldn't move the stuff. So it was on the jetty. We were in the ships alongside the jetty, and of course they came over and bombed us to do what they'd been trying to do at sea. So that wasn't a very pleasant period. Meantime, the invasion of North Africa took place. So there were no naval escorts to take us back, because we were all merchant ships, you see. And we were there until December, and had to be broken out of the White Sea and get back. We got clear of the White Sea, and then there was a hell of a snowstorm, a gale, and it completely scattered the convoy. So we all made our way back to, we went to Newcastle, and we all made our own way back. One or two were picked off by U-boats, but the weather was very bad, fortunately. Not good for U-boat operation, and we, by the skin of our teeth, we managed to get home.
Had the ship been escort. Had the ship been damaged?
No, nothing, no way.
What did you see, if anything, of Russia?
Well, again, you don't do too much, because the NKVD, I think that's what it was called, were watching us all the time. But the interesting thing was that the Inturist was a place where people could go and have a meal away from the ship, servicemen. But it was, in fact, an officer's club in a communist country, and ratings were not particularly welcome. In fact, I don't think they were allowed in. I never saw any. And there were Russian officers all over the place, of course, and they were knocking back vodka and so on and so forth. There we are.
Did you see anything of life in the area?
Yes, so they're all complete and utter peasants. And they had women stevedores unloading the ships. And they were brutally treated at times. And I think one of the most fascinating things I saw was that there were ferries from Archangel itself across to Bakaritsa, which was across the Dvina, the River Dvina. And they were absolutely overloaded when they were taking people to work every morning and bringing them back at night. And eventually, of course, the Dvina began to freeze over and the ferries couldn't operate. So they used to go across the ice, you know, testing it during the time it was halfway through freezing over, so to speak. And then one chap would go in, you see, he'd crack the ice and go in. I'll say, well, it's we can't do it today. And they walked away and left him. He died.
What do you mean he cracked the ice and went
over? Well, he was testing the ice to see if it would bear them to go across.
He just fell in?
Just fell in. Just went through the ice and that was it.
So he was a guinea pig?
That's right.
Didn't they attempt to rescue him?
Well, how could they? They couldn't get there themselves. There were no boats near.
Who was this individual?
Well, he was a civilian, one of the workers. Frightening, really, when you think about it, isn't it? In this day and age.
What did you mean about brutal treatment of stevedores?
Well, they were at every ship's gangway. There was a Russian sentry. And these women, they used to... I never saw this incident, but I'm told it happened. Women stevedores used to steal loaves of bread. If they were loading bread onto one of our ships, they'd steal the loaf and stuff it up their jumpers like that, you see. And if a if a guard saw them, he would just hammer them with his rifle butt, women and all. I'm told, but one was killed. I can't vouch for that at all. It was fairly brutal.
Could you have any communication with the Russians?
Yes, there were one or two reporters who were a little bit more civil, if you like, than or less suspicious, let us say, than the majority of people towards us. But it was only fleeting knowledge of them. I didn't really see them very much.
Any other memories of life in Russia?
Not really. You couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't do anything. There was no transport. I mean, it was a question of a walk into the country a little bit and generally aboard the ship. And one of our officers, he started painting his cabin for something to do. We just could do nothing. We weren't allowed to do anything ashore. We couldn't get an escort to bring us home. And it was a frustrating experience, to be honest.
Were conditions aboard Empire Morn any different from what they had been aboard Empire Franklin?
Not really, because they're both owned and run by, under Admiralty supervision, of course, by private companies. And they were both, in those two cases, they were from the Tyneside, which were very small companies and didn't have quite the experience of larger companies. Another one I sailed in was being run by the Blue Funnel Line. Now, that was a different matter altogether. Proper stewards and the accommodation was very much superior. But, you just went where you were told.
Which ship was that?
I can't remember its name. Can't remember its name.
Anyway, Empire Morn came back to Britain.
To the Tyne, yes.
And what happened then?
Well, that was the last trip I did, I think. And in... yes, I was discharged. Well, MSFU became superfluous to requirement for the simple reason what we call the Woolworth carriers came on the scene. That was other than the fleet carriers, small ones, quickly built, and very, very useful ships they were too. So really, we'd served our purpose, and the unit was disbanded eventually in about February or March 1943. And we all disbanded. I went to a refresher course at our RNAS in Yeovilton, where we had by this time set up a wonderful system like the RAF at Fighter Command Headquarters in Yeovilton, which still exists. That's where all the fighter direction officers are trained. And I did a very useful course there, because things had obviously moved on quite a lot since I'd done the first one in 1941. And then I appeared to please the examiners, who, and the course instructors, and they gave me a job as a night fighter direction officer at a little place called Cobenspath, which was attached to RNAS Drem in Scotland, as an instructor. And I was there virtually on and off the rest of the war. I became the senior instructor when we were teaching RN officers, the principles of fighter direction at night with Firefly aircraft launched from carriers. And I used to take a flight of Fireflies on Woolworth's carriers again over to the, as a unit, we went in a carrier and did raids off the Norwegian coast. But we were never used, in fact. No aircraft attacked us at night. It was in the air direction room. I was the officer on watch from dusk until dawn, you see, with the Firefly standing by in case of night attack. But we were never used in that respect. And so I eventually returned to Drem as by then the senior instructor. And as I say, we did that three or four times over a year or so, something like that. And then we had a longer period when I was instructed to join a frigate, which had been especially adapted for night fighter operation, and it was specifically intended to try and repel attackers with the V1. And those were launched from Heinkel 111s over the Belgian coast towards London. And I was the fighter direction officer aboard there, and I was given the control of two Mosquitoes from RAF Coltishall in Norfolk. And I had these two aircraft patrolling a line across the Belgian coast where we knew the Heinkels, which came over the sea at sea level and then had to go to 2,000 feet to launch the V1s. Now, unfortunately, the patrol line was of such a length that I never was able to catch any of them rising to 2,000 feet. I never had one in the right spot. It's purely a matter of luck, I maintain, and I think I was right. The other point, of course, was that the German minefields were in such a position off the Belgian coast that we really couldn't get near enough to the launching situation. We were just that too far away. You see, really, our 10-centimetre radar was an extension of the shore-based RAF radar on the UK coast. And this was the intention, that we should get that position where the Heinkel rose to 2,000 feet and launched. But we never achieved that. I mean, RAF controllers came out with me and they said, well, it's one of those things. And so that was abandoned. And then I returned to...
Which ship were you in then?
HMS Caicos, a colony-class frigate, American-built. And then I finished my time as an instructor. By then, of course, VE Day had happened. And then it was the Far East we were concentrating on, of course. And I joined a fighter direction tender, which was a landing ship tank. And it was equipped... It was an awful-looking ship with bedsteads like the old Chainholm low stations on deck. A terrible-looking thing, but very effective. It was an RAF come Navy air direction room in the bowels of this landing ship tank, which had nothing else aboard, of course. No tanks or anything like that. It was purely a control station. And the intention was that we should join the Far Eastern Fleet and again be a kind of outrider, giving early warning of approach and, of course, controlling as well, because we had RAF and naval controllers on board this ship. But again, we didn't have a lot of luck, because, well, not a lot of luck, probably we did have every bit of luck, but we got down to, and we were just off Gibraltar, and VJ Day happened. So we went into Gibraltar, and the captain and I went ashore, and everybody was still recovering from the celebration of VJVE Day, or VJ Day, should I say. And so he didn't get any clear instruction from the Gibraltar headquarters. So I said, well, we'll proceed as instructed. We'll go to Malta. So he said, have you ever seen the Spanish coast from the sea, Gostela? I said, no, I haven't, sir. He said, we'll do that. So he said, we took the ship up the Spanish coast, and at noon every day, we stopped the ship, and everybody over the side, except the officer of the watch, went for a swim. And we got to Malta and awaited further instructions, which were eventually to return us to UK, of course. And that's as far as we got, to the Far East.
What was the name of this tender?
FDT-13. Didn't have a name. Fighter Direction Tender 13. And that was really the end of my war, I suppose.
How do you feel now about having served in the RNVR in the war?
Well, having survived it, it was the finest education I could have ever have had. It was really marvellous. It gave me an experience which I otherwise would not have enjoyed.
Did you have any narrow escapes from death or casualty during the war?
Well, I suppose that Norway, if another bomb had dropped, it might have hit the transmitting station. And I could certainly hear Beaufort shells whistling around my ears when we were on the deck of Empire Morn in PQ-18. And one or two close shaves, I suppose, in various convoys, but those were the outstanding ones, I think.
What were the main problems in doing your job as fighter direction controller?
Main problems? Well, I think the fact that we were the whole time during the war, we were learning our trade, so to speak. I mean, it was brand new in 1941 to the Royal Navy. And, of course, there were other demands upon their wherewithal and the fact that they could not produce the right kind of equipment swiftly enough for us. So it was all the time we were learning, if you understand.